Welcome, fellow gamers, to another chapter of Librum of the DM. We are in double digits for chapters, recording chapter 10 today concerning Rangers. I am DM Mike.
I am DM Med.
And I am DM Saul.
Today is June 10th, 2018. This is unfortunately our second attempt at recording this episode. We tried last Wednesday, and unfortunately, we had some internet issues which caused most of what we recorded to be all warbly. So we're trying again. Let's go right into what we've been doing. DM Ed, what have you been up to?
Not a whole much. Got a Roll20 game that I'm going to possibly play in tonight, but I might actually take a break because I've been showing up constantly. We played last Sunday as well, but it was just myself, the DM, and a new guy that had never played D&D or used Roll20 before. So that was interesting. Other than that, it's just been the forum games, and I am on book 3 in the Lost Empire series.
I had a session of my game last Sunday. The Necromancer's Tower that the party was clearing out and clearing around, they finally finished that job and they got rid of all the undead leading to it. So they turned that quest in and got a decent sum of money, about 60 silver each. And then after that, during some downtime, they were approached by a mysterious figure who had been watching them while they were doing this quest. And he remarked that they handled it fairly well and he was impressed and thought that they had potential, so he gave them another quest. They had to go meet with a gnomish tinker. They have been heading up to him and looking for him. Session ended with some downtime going awry. My world is fairly racist against elves due to some of the history of the world. So one of the elf players, when they went to a tavern to spend the night, interacted with a particularly angry attendant. And when the NPC wanted him to leave, he decided that he would, instead of bowing down and leave, he would stand his ground, which caused the NPC to get a little bit physical, and when he, as a wizard, could not overpower him, he shot him with a magic missile, killed the poor civilian, and then was attacked and killed by guards. So, at the moment, the rest of the party is running away from guards, as they are suspects of through affiliation, and they're trying to figure out what to do, because this character just murdered someone, and then they had to fight their way through the angry mob of people. So, I was not expecting that whatsoever, and the next session that I host is, I'm not sure what I'm doing with it yet. I need to figure that out.
I have been up to work. I've spent the last 3.5 weeks working from pretty much the time I get up to the time I go to bed. So that is why we missed a podcast here and there. Unfortunately, I didn't have a way to make time to record or do editing. So we just kind of skipped the last episode recording time and decided that we were going to try to squeeze it in this weekend. And hopefully this records well. And on another note, I would like to mention that I was looking through my D&D stuff. And in one episode, I kind of slammed the new DM screens that came out with release of the skills and powers. And I came to find out there were actually two screens that came with it. And one of them was actually extremely useful. So I apologize for kind of bashing it a little bit. It actually is much better than I thought it was. So let's move on to our listener questions. Our first question comes from Hinder. He has a question for the show, which is, how do you handle toxic players? At what point do you determine a player to be toxic? And if you do you kill off their character and remove them from the game or do something else? Finally, have you ever had a group break up because of one toxic player? Typically, my groups don't have a lot in the way of toxic players. Looking back at some of my earlier gaming sessions back in my teens and early 20s, I did have some high school friends that would probably be considered toxic players. I should have done more to handle the situation, but unfortunately, I was still green enough to where I didn't quite know how to handle them. So we just kind of played with the game the way it was rolling. And if I were to happen to have characters like that now, there would definitely be some changes.
I've luckily never had any player that was so toxic that I needed to kick them out or remove them. I have had a couple of players who got really into their character, but they made a very intrusive character, a very obnoxious character. That was, when they got into the character, ruining the game for everybody else. I had to pull them aside and tell them that they need to tone back the character or bring more realistic standards to what they're trying to do with the character, or else I will have to have them change characters, because it was just kind of ruining everybody else's fun. But I've never had to kick anybody out.
I had a similar experience with a guy online in one of my play-by-post games where he was just getting a little too into his character, and his character was coming off as a huge jerk. And some of the other players had sent me some private messages saying, hey, if he doesn't tone it down, we're probably going to have to leave the game. So I just confronted him in private, said the same thing, you know, said, look, you got a couple players that are really not thrilled with the way you're playing your game. If you could just tone him down a little bit, your guy would be probably acceptable and nobody would want to leave. So he did, and pretty much the game has continued on. We've only had one of those people that confronted me leave the game, but that was just because they're taking kind of a break from a lot of their gaming so they can focus on some real life stuff. Other than that, it's mostly just been some other online game experiences, like on Google Hangouts in the past. There's been some pretty out of control players that almost made the whole group break up, but then eventually that player just stopped showing up, so we continued on without him.
I think to your comment of real life getting in the way, a lot of us don't have a ton of time to sit here and deal with players that are going to be disruptive. When I do have time to play, and that's every other Sunday, I want to use that time as constructively as possible. So by today's standards, by the way I DM now, I would not tolerate a toxic player for very long. To answer his second question, I've never had a group break up because of a toxic player, but I have had a toxic player that bailed on my game because we tried to do one night of, and I think I've mentioned this before, we tried to do one night of just everybody drawing a character out of a hat, playing some characters with some normal stats, and he got mad and left the group for 6 months. So he left, the toxic player left, but as far as everybody else went, I have not had a group leave because of one player. So Hinder, I hope that answers your question. Moving on to Dave Wagner's question, we're going to talk about room descriptions. He says, say the party is exploring in a dark dungeon, and they're relying on infravision 60 foot or a light source, say 30 feet. If they enter a large or longer room where their vision would not reach the furthest content of the room, do you still describe this room and all of its features, or do you delay handing out the information until the group explores further? For example, an elf with 60 foot infravision is scouting ahead and peers into a darkened room. There's a door on the far wall that is 80 feet away. Does the player controlling the elf learn of this room immediately, or do you limit the initial description to only what they can actually see at the time? I use infravision as a heat source method. It is a varying degree of heat that they can see as they're exploring. I know that some of the rules and some of the later editions say that this is a true dark sight vision, but I play by the old first edition rules where it is a source of not being able to see in the dark without any source of light. There is a spell called Ultravision and ability called Ultravision that allow that, so I basically run with three sources of light. To answer his question, though, I do not give the party any kind of description to what they're exploring without them being able to actually see it. So if they can only see 30 feet, I'm only telling them what they see within that 30 feet.
Mine depends on what they're doing. If they're stepping into a 90-foot long room with a 30-foot light source, I typically assume that they're exploring the room. So unless there's some kind of trap on the other end that I want to keep hidden from them, or there's some relic or potential story or dungeon relevant item that I want them to explicitly tell me that they're looking for, then I'll just describe the whole thing to them, and I'll let them know that something along the lines of, as you step into the room, you look around, you examine the walls, the floorboards, and this is what's going on. If they're peeking into the room, however, I will limit it very strictly to only what they can see. If a player tells me he's going to crack open a door and peek in and he can only see 30 feet or say 60 feet, I'm not going to tell him what's 70 feet into the room because that's not where his vision goes. So it really depends on what the players, how the players are approaching the room for me and the significance of it.
I'm a little bit different on that just because it's play by post gaming that I mostly run. So if I were to delay showing certain parts of a map to a group, waiting for the one player that happens to have infravision or the one player that happens to be carrying a lantern or a torch to say, oh yeah, I explore the room and describe it to the other players, I just kind of post up the map and assume that the character has already walked through and this is what they've all seen because they stuck with the guy that had the light source, or they, the ones that have infravision, went around the room and they just kind of described it to the other guys just to speed things along. Because the one thing that does happen in play-by-post games is it will sometimes get bogged down when you have certain players that you give key information to, and they only log in maybe once every 2 weeks to make a post. So I kind of run infravision as kind of both like dark vision and you see heat signatures. I'll give the full room description just so I can keep the game moving instead of having it hung up on somebody that went in to explore the room and then takes a week to tell the other players what they found.
Yeah, I think in a play-by-post, I would probably handle that very similar. I've also been known to pull characters aside, describe what they're seeing as they're exploring ahead of the group, and let them report back what they feel is pertinent information. I think that sometimes that you lose some of the role-playing opportunities when you tell everybody what's going on in a face-to-face game, and everybody just kind of adjusts and they're throwing out comments without actually being where they're at. So to make the realism a little bit better, I just pull them aside. I tell them what's going on. We do a little bit of role-playing, and then they go back to the group, and they can tell them what they find.
Or I suppose in an alternate option, if you happen to have a map, you can say, oh, well, since you're the one that actually went around the room, this is what you see, and you just kind of hide it behind the screen just so that one player could see it.
I even try to touch a little bit on line of sight. If a character is peering in a door, I try to angle the map with the way they're standing with the door, and I'll only describe what they're seeing through the crack in the door versus what they might see within 30 feet. So it'll be more of a line of sight than the actual length of their vision. So I hope that answers Dave's question on the room descriptions. If you have any other questions or comments, please feel free to contact us at our email at librumofthedm@gmail.com. Visit our Google community page, which is Librum of the DM, or leave us a message on Twitter or Podomatic. Moving on to our first section, Pages of the Dungeon Master, we're going to talk about the Ranger class kits, Forest Runner and Seeker. Let's talk first about the Forest Runner. The basic description of the Forest Runner is, whenever a corrupt or oppressive regime holds power, there's bound to be a Forest Runner. Forest Runner rise in opposition to such regimes, living on the fringes of society, usually one step ahead of the law. They're criminals only in a technical sense, as they adhere to a personal code that compels them to wage war against greedy aristocrats and unjust rulers. While the powers that be view the Forest Runner as a lawless troublemaker, commoners see him as a hero, perhaps their best hope against a tyrannical government. A Forest Runner must have a charisma score of at least 12. The Forest Runner is usually selfless, resourceful, and roguishly charming. A loner by circumstances and not by choice, a Forest Runner readily allies with adventuring parties who share his outlook. As a champion of underdogs everywhere, the Forest Runner doesn't necessarily feel bound to his homeland and may journey anywhere in the world to promote justice. Occasionally, he may join a party to acquire treasure for distribution to the needy. If the local authorities are putting the heat on, he may accompany a party simply to disappear for a while. I've only had one character actually run with a Forest Runner, and he played him very much like Robin Hood. Robin Hood being that he was helping the oppressed, he was fighting against the corrupt government, and basically trying to help the peasants and the farmers get a say in what was going on in the campaign world at that time.
I like the Forest Runner kit, as it provides a very mechanical advantage to the type of role-playing that this is aimed at. I've had a lot of players play characters like this, where they wanted to go with a homebound champion, Robin Hood, Aragorn-type character. And that's pretty much what this is designed to accommodate. You're allowed to use standard equipment and armor. Gives you the special benefits of stealth in natural settings. And you can inspire your companions with morale boosts and whatnot. You can also take the disguise proficiency, which is normally a rogue skill. And if you're going to roleplay that type of underdog type character, it's pretty fantastic. However, that being said, this is a kit that I would pretty strictly enforce the roleplaying aspect of, as the only hindrances are strictly roleplaying. Under special hindrances, it says that Forest Runners will rarely develop a close relationship with any NPC with political power. Additionally, a Forest Runner runs a constant risk of arrest by authorities of his homeland, as well as from other regimes with which his homeland has extradition agreements. Law enforcement authorities may plague a Forest Runner through his entire career. The hindrances put a lot of pressure on the DM to follow through with making sure that this character is in constant watch from the law.
I haven't ever played this kit, and I don't think I've ever had anybody play it either in any of my games. I can see the benefits of it, but again, you're also going to have to always act like you're kind of a wanted person and having to duck out of the way, hide, or disguise yourself so that the law doesn't find you just because of that thin line that you're constantly crossing.
I think one of the things to note about a lot of the kits found in a lot of the books is that their hindrances are typically a role-playing element. Some of them have the bonuses that are a role-playing experience as well, but it seems like in a lot of the later books, the bonuses were actual mechanical bonuses, but the hindrances were role-playing bonuses. So this is going to put a lot of work on a lot of DMs So if you are going to allow a lot of the kits into your games, you're going to have to be ready to do the role-playing that is necessary to make sure that the hindrances actually come out and they're suffering something for taking all of the bonuses they get with the kit.
The only place I think I've actually recall seeing a Forest Runner mentioned is actually in the series that I'm reading, Forgotten Realms, Lost Empires. The first book, they actually have the primary character is a ranger, so he's at a ranger's gathering, and they happen to have a Forest Runner who's there from the Dale Lands, who happens to be running between them and the Zentrum.
I really like the ranger gatherings. Let me see if I can remember what they're called.
I think they're called Four Gatherings.
Yeah, the Four Gatherings is basically just a ranger potluck. Just everybody show up and bring yourselves and like a couple cookies, and we'll have a good merry old time of hanging out and catching up on what monsters we've slain. That's probably one of my most favorite role-playing aspects of the ranger, that I've never had a character play a ranger long enough to actually really include that.
That's actually the first time I've heard of such a thing.
It's in the Complete Ranger's Handbook. They actually talk about Four Gatherings.
I guess I need to delve a little bit deeper into the books. I have gone over them when it comes to characters rolling up kits, but I can't honestly say that I've been able to read every single one of these cover to cover. I think it's kind of a fun role-playing addition, too, that it says that any time after reaching fourth level, the Forest Runner will acquire a personal nemesis. This is an NPC of near equal level whose campaign goal is to capture or kill the Forest Runner. If you're playing this to the way it's designed, I think that can be a very fun aspect of the game where even if they go off adventuring, you might have this small group, a small retinue of NPCs that are trying to chase down this character so they can bring him back to justice or maybe even just kill him. So it's a fun little kit. Be prepared as a DM to make some accommodations for a lot of the kits that you do allow in your games. Let's move on next to our Seeker kit.
So the Seeker is devoted to spiritual awareness and self-enlightenment. He's almost like a monk or a paladin type character, possibly even a cleric if you wanted to go that far. The Seeker's deep beliefs affect him more than any other elements of his life. The Seeker seeks fulfillment by following the tenets of his or her faith and striving to understand the relationship between himself and the natural world. He views animal followers as fellow travelers on his spiritual journey. A Seeker must have a wisdom score of 15 or more, along with all of the other requirements that a ranger has. Good people of all cultures tend to look favorably upon Seekers. At worst, Seekers are dismissed as useless but harmless eccentrics. More often, they're regarded as sensitive seekers of truth, admired and respected for their devotion. Priests of compatible alignment are especially deferential to Seekers. Even if such a priest follows a different belief system, they recognize that the Seeker shares their veneration of a higher power. Though Seekers generally prefer solitude, they constantly seek opportunities to broaden their outlook and stimulate spiritual insight. For those reasons, they may join adventuring parties solely for the promise of new experiences. Moral considerations also motivate Seekers. Parties can sometimes recruit Seekers by appealing to their sense of justice.
I've never had a player play this kit, but I do find it to be a very interesting read, and it could be a lot of fun for a campaign. I went through this when we started talking about it for this episode, and I found the whole aspect of a ranger who gets spells at sixth level and able to cast spells up to fourth level an interesting twist on what the ranger normally is. This guy is spiritual versus any other type of ranger class, and his devotion to his deity or what he follows is the main point of this class versus where other rangers are protecting the wild, protecting the forest. So using them as a more devout type of a character class, you can kind of bring in some of those religious elements versus just running the ranger as a straight forest type person.
The Seeker reminds me of the paladin in quite a few ways. It gets its powers from a deity, but also from an oath or a goal in life that it's pursuing. It gets a little bit more powerful powers, and it also has a lot of roleplay restrictions in a way. A lot of the paladin's restrictions aren't often mechanical, but things that must occur in game, which this also has. Examples of that are it needs to have a sacred animal. And once you choose the sacred animal based on what terrain you're in, you have to take care of the sacred animal. If you find one in the wild, you have to take care of it. Otherwise, your powers will be damaged. And you will enter a state of mourning, it says, which if you violate these things to such a degree of ignoring a creature and then having it die, you could be in a period of mourning for an entire in-game month if you ignore your responsibilities as this character enough. It also brings some variations that I think are interesting, such as your species enemy, which I think we talk about later, doesn't necessarily need to be a creature type, but it could be a religious body. You could choose a certain religion or followers of a certain god to be your species enemy. Along with that, it also has restrictions on what is typically what is typical of a warrior, as you pretty much have the retinue of a druid with a lot of your equipment. You're very restricted on your weapons, and you can't really wear much armor. So as Mike was saying, for a religious setting, or to add some variation to the cast of of rangers that are in the world, this character is like a splash, like a fresh coat of paint, almost.
I think it's interesting you bring up the weapon proficiencies, because this particular kit does not even allow the ranger to use a sword. He's stuck using more druidish-type weapons, crossbow, dagger, dart, knife, quarterstaff, sickle, or sling.
Yeah, so pretty much, in essence, it's a druid ranger.
Without having a multi-class.
Yeah, without having to be a multi-class. So it has those perks, I guess you could call it.
In a way.
And then the whole sacred animal, that's kind of an added hindrance that could happen. If it does die, then your character's probably worthless for a while.
It would definitely extend that responsibility onto the rest of the party if you are one of the healers or support characters of the party, as you can't be incredibly combat-centered.
This is one of those kits where the hindrances are more of a role-playing aspect than they are necessarily of a mechanical base. The only hindrance that it shows that might be considered mechanical is that the fact that they will lose their spellcasting abilities if they're not in compliance with their religious principles. So if they do intentionally hurt one of their totem animals, or if they don't liberate captive sacred animals, they'll lose their spellcasting abilities, but they maintain everything else. They do go into that period of mourning, which I still believe is more of a role-playing aspect of the game. So you might take the character out for a little bit, but there's no real mechanical disadvantage to them not following their kit. So as a DM, you've got to stay on top of this and make sure that they're doing everything that they need to do. And when they play a kit like this, you need to throw in those instances where this is going to come into play.
Yeah, so you basically just have a separate encounter planned out that's going to be the seeker finding their sacred animal. You know, there's not really much more I can say about the kit myself, because I've never played it. I don't think I've ever had anyone play it in a game. I haven't even had any books that I've read recently or in the past that have included seekers that I know of.
While we are on the topic of kits, I would like to point out the Greenwood Ranger, which I know we didn't mention in this, but I feel like is worth mentioning. The Greenwood Ranger, once you reach, I believe it's 5th level, you grow a skin of bark, like a shell, over your body, which gives you special powers and hindrances that are in fact mechanical. You take more damage from fire now, but you can also root yourself into the ground and heal through photosynthesis. You can't wear armor once you get this coating, but as you level up, the armor scales with you to give you a better AC as you get higher in levels. And it also gives you a broader range of like plant and nature related spells. It's one of the more interesting ones, but it also does say that it is the rarest form of ranger, so the odds of someone actually running into this is incredibly slim.
I think this kind of goes back to the Groot reference that Saul made in the last episode.
Yes, this is what I was thinking of once we were ending that episode, as I was looking forward to this moment.
Well, you know, the funny thing about this guy is, too, he's got a required terrain. It can either be forest or jungle, but that's it.
Hard to be a tree in the mountains, though.
Right, but you can see why this would be one of the more rare ranger kits to come across. If you're only going to encounter them in the jungle or forest, they're less likely to be something you run into.
Very true.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of this particular kit is limbing. This allows them to plant themselves in the ground for 24 hours, and when they awaken, if they've been undisturbed, they have a new limb sprouting out of their body. This allows them to hold 3 weapons. It allows them to get multiple attacks per round. They are made with a -2 penalty for the 3rd attack with the extra limb, but it's a really interesting aspect to this particular kit.
And it also says that they do get to have at least one treant follower.
Yes, that they're allowed to have treants. That's right. I forgot about that.
Well, when you started talking about it, they kind of sound like they're already part treant to begin with.
Yes. The most difficult part about this is probably to become a Greenwood Ranger. You have to create a pact with your deity that is granting you your powers. And once you reach the fourth or fifth level, if your deity determines that you have not lived up to that pact high enough, he will take away your Greenwood powers, and he will also ban you from taking up any other ranger kit ever. So you have to make sure that, again, this is going back to the enforcing the requirements of a kit. As a DM, you have to really crack down on your players during the introductory process to make sure they're actually following through with what they're supposed to, because if they're not, they could be delegitimized for this position.
One thing to note, too, is this one actually has hindrances that are mechanical. He loses 5% when he's trying to move silently. He's vulnerable to fire. He's vulnerable to extreme climates. And he also has limited magic. So he's limited to only casting spells from the plant sphere as opposed to plant and animal. He also receives a reaction penalty because of his bizarre appearance. So he suffers a minus 3 reaction adjustment when encountering NPCs and the like.
Yeah, I would have a hard time even trying to see how you could fit this into a regular adventuring group.
If it was a party of druids and seekers, you might be able to get away with it.
Like a lot of the other kits, this particular kit is very hard to fit into an ongoing campaign. It'd be great for a one-off or maybe a short campaign, but when you start looking at the overall long-term campaign, a lot of these kits don't necessarily fit the bill too much. So that's our take on the Forest Runner Seeker and Greenwood Ranger. Let us know what you think. If you've ever played these or seen them played, let us know how it went. Let's move on to our next section, which is Pages of the Beast. Today, instead of talking about a specific monster, we're going to talk about the Ranger's favorite enemies.
Otherwise known as species enemy.
The Player's Handbook gives a very basic list of suggestions for what the Ranger can use as their favorite enemy. The Complete Ranger's Handbook goes into a little more depth of what you can use. On pages 20 and 21, there are tables that can be used to help a ranger select what his species enemies is based on the primary terrain he selected for the ranger. Rangers gain special combat modifiers when encountering his species enemies, reflecting his knowledge of both the creature and his intense emotions. The player must choose his ranger species enemies before the character advances to second level. I like the species enemies. It's fun to watch a brand new player roll up a character. Most of my characters tend to try to pick their species enemies before they even start the game, so they try to incorporate it into their background, but they struggle with, do I want to pick something that I'm going to face a lot in the beginning, or something that I might face a little later in the game? Because once you pick your species enemies, you're stuck with that as your species enemies. If you choose goblins or orcs, as you advance in levels, encountering these is going to become less and less as you start facing off against some tougher monsters.
And likewise, if you choose a stronger monster, you may only run into one once or twice. If you choose, say, a beholder to be your species enemy, you're not really just going to come across beholders. You typically raid their homes or catch them as they're performing some form of ritual or something like that. So if you choose one of the more powerful creatures, the odds of this actually becoming useful at that point tends to, I suppose, go down.
It's kind of like a double-edged sword. You're either going to encounter a lot or little of them to start out with at lower levels, or a lot or a little of them when you get up to higher levels.
There's no guarantee that a ranger is ever going to come across any of his species enemy, especially if he picks something a little more off the wall. If they pick trolls or a specific giant or some of the more common monsters, he may face off against them a little bit more. But if you're choosing something off the wall like a beholder, you're not going to run across them very often. Not many DMs want to throw in many beholders into their game, especially just to accommodate the ranger.
I'm going to go with the gelatinous cube as my species enemy.
Mine is the Argos.
I'm going to pick the Audiog.
Oh, come on. I figured you'd choose the gibbering mouth.
Maybe I'll pick mimics.
How about doppelgangers?
So I think something to consider when you're picking these is you don't want to pick something too obscure, but you want to pick something that will benefit the ranger some course of his adventure. As a DM, I do try to accommodate the rangers, but my campaigns are kind of set the way they are. So if they're picking something off the wall, they may never, unfortunately, run into that particular species enemy.
I try to let my rangers know when they're being made and they're choosing their species enemy, whether or not what they're going to choose is actually going to be encountered.
Well, yeah, if they decided to pick a troll and you decided that trolls don't exist in this part of the world or any part of your world, you definitely want to let them know so that they're not wasting their pick on something that doesn't even exist.
So, like, if I jumped into Mike's world and said, I'm going to use gnomes as my species enemy, yeah, you're going to have to pick again, buddy, because those guys don't exist.
Only one race of gnome exists in my world, and that's the deep gnome.
Hey, so I'd still be okay.
You just wouldn't run across them too much unless you're doing a lot of underground delving with your ranger.
Ed, gnome hunter.
I think I'm going to build an underground tunnel to go to the vampire lord.
We need to get into that wizard's tower. Guys, I believe that this justifies a tunnel. You mean the top floor? We'll tunnel in. They'll never see us coming. We'll get in from the inside.
Yeah, but we got to dig down deep enough so that I can run into my species enemy, dammit.
So yeah, if a player decides to take some time and delve into your world a little bit to find out what are more common monsters, that might be the best way for them to go. I know if they pick undead in my world, they wouldn't be going wrong too much. Pick vampires.
Yeah, I mean, there's the bonus of you get a +4 to your attack, but, you know, you also have the problem of, hey, we're facing a giant, but the ranger's species enemy is over there, so he's focused on killing all of his species enemy while we're facing the giant.
True, I suppose we didn't mention that, did we? When you encounter your species enemy as a ranger, you are so overwhelmed with your hatred or your determination to slay this creature that you have to target your species enemy when in combat, even if there are other threats.
Another drawback to picking orcs and goblins, because any clever DM can throw in a couple goblins and orcs when you're fighting a bunch of giants, and unfortunately the ranger's now tied up for the next round or two killing orcs where everybody else is stuck fighting the giant. So yeah, that brings up a very good point.
Yeah, you're almost like a barbarian going into a berserk rage when you see your favored or species enemy. So as the ranger, you're uncontrollable and you're facing these guys while everybody else is trying to think strategically and say, we need to take down the bigger threat first.
And that plays into the -4 penalty to encounter reactions. If he can make his save, he can attack whatever he wants. But with that -4 penalty, there's a really good chance he's going to be facing off against whatever his species enemy is. So what's your favorite enemy? What favorite enemies have you seen in some of your games? Let us know. Moving on to our next section, pages of the spellcasters, we're going to talk about several of the ranger spells. These are the animal friendship spell and pass without trace. One thing to keep in mind is rangers have access to only the animal and plant spheres that are on the divine side of the spellcasting, and at 8th level they can cast one first level priest spell from either of those spheres. Take it away, Ed.
Sure. So starting out with animal friendship, it is a first level priest spell that happens to be in the animal sphere, which is on page 252 of the revised player's handbook.
And for those playing along at home, it is found on page 28 of the Pre-Spell Compendium, Volume 1.
This spell allows a ranger to show any animal with intelligence of 1 to 4 that they wish to become friends. The animal gets a saving throw versus spell. If it fails, then it follows the ranger around like it's its best buddy, its pet. And you can pretty much get it to do anything that you desire in some sense, like if the ranger is intending to eat the squirrel that it has now befriended, the squirrel is going to run off and try and find traps to kill itself in, basically so the ranger can eat it. You can actually teach this tricks, but you have to do it within the first 3 months that you acquire this animal that you've become friends with through the spell. But it's just kind of generic tricks that you would teach a pet. Not anything super uber helpful necessarily, but you could teach it some things. With the spell, they can actually attract up to 2 hit dice worth of animals per level that they possess, no more than twice what their experience level is.
One of the things to note is the material component for this spell is his holy symbol and food.
If you have your holy symbol and a bunch of fish, you could attract a nice little bear as your pet.
With enough hit dice, yeah. I had a player that had this for my previous campaign that ended a couple months ago, and she used it to befriend a falcon, which turned out to be an incredible boon, as she could send it off to retrieve things, she could send it off to keep watch, and she taught it to alert them if it saw anything approaching, so she could send it to go stand somewhere while they were working on something, and then if an animal or some other creature was approaching, it could alert them. The biggest benefit of this, I think, at least from what I saw, is the fact that it will go off and help perform whatever the druid, not the druid, but whatever the ranger is attempting to achieve. So it's very similar to a wizard's familiar, except you can't share senses with it, and you also have a lot more control, because as opposed to just sending it off and having it do its own thing, it actually almost has an emotional desire to complete what you're also trying to complete.
It's actually a very effective low-level spell. I don't know why more of my clerics slash druids slash rangers don't use it, but it's very beneficial, especially when you're wandering through the wilderness and you need help from the local animal life. You cast this and you might be able to convince them to help you. It works well with conjunction with the Speak with Animals spell, but as long as you can befriend them, you can get their aid and their help while you're traveling through their territory.
And I think there was one part that I did forget to mention about the spell is if the animal that you have managed to befriend with this spell is left alone for a certain period of time, it will revert back to its normal wild self and just disappear as if it never even knew the ranger.
So, but don't neglect your little friend then? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in a sense, pretty much.
So let's talk about the Pass Without Trace spell.
All right, Pass Without Trace is a first level priest spell in the plant sphere on page 256 of the Revised Player's Handbook.
And found on page 444 of the Priest Spell Compendium, Volume 2.
Yes. Okay. By means of this spell, you can pretty much pass through any terrain, leaving absolutely no footprints and no scent. So, pretty much, you can leave nothing to track you by, except the only downside of this spell is that if anybody casts Detect Magic in anywhere that you have gone while under the Pass Without Trace spell, they will detect an aura of magic, so they could track you by those means, but that would be a very uncommon method, I would think, for most people trying to find you if you're a ranger and you're trying to duck out of the way and avoid contact with certain people. They're probably not going to be casting Detect Magic to look for you.
Once you have that caliber of NPC trying to find you, you have bigger problems than really anything else that you had going on. If that's what you're trying to avoid, then you need to talk to your party.
Yeah, it says here in the spell description that the radiation of magic is for 1d6 turns. It can last anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour. So you do want to be careful if you know you're being followed by somebody with a spellcasting ability. You want to keep that in mind that it might not actually help you as much as you hope it does.
However, if you are playing a Robin Hood-esque campaign or you're playing in a campaign in which you are an outlaw to one degree or another, this is an incredible spell. I've not seen this used, but I have used it to have some thieves get away from the players, and it works incredibly well. You sneak, once you're hidden and you're hiding in shadows, you cast the spell, and you just kind of disappear. If they don't think to cast Detect Magic, then there's really nothing to find you with.
I think one of the things we should point out, too, is that you need to make sure you have enough for everybody in the party. This only affects one creature touched, so if you have a party of six, you need to have six of these prepped.
Well, you see, the way I have used the spell as a ranger, I was scouting ahead, and I accidentally made a noise, and these bandits started trying to chase me, so used the Pass Without Trace spell. Now they can't find me, they can't find tracks to track me back to the group, and now I can let the group know, hey, they know that we're out here, or at least that someone's out here.
Going back to what Mike was saying, something to keep in mind as well is that the material components are a sprig of pine or evergreen, which you do have to burn while you're casting the spell. So it's a pretty common resource, but if you're playing in an urban-based setting or if you're playing in a mountainous setting, then casting this on your entire party could become difficult.
Yeah, when they go, hey, what's all that smoke?
True, that release is a pretty strong scent. Evergreen is very distinct.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever burned either pine or evergreen, other types of branches. It leaves a pretty good thick cloud of smoke, usually, too.
Well, it says just a sprig, so it doesn't have to be that big. You could burn something quite small when you're casting the spell, I would think.
Yeah, but you never know. Even a small sprig of it could still leave a pretty good thing of smoke, especially if you're doing a whole party.
Well, if you're doing a whole party, you might want to wait till you get the third level spell to get the 10-foot radius bonus of the spell.
Yeah, that would be a lot more useful to a group. I can see this is more like to an individual. So maybe you cast it on yourself because you're the advanced scout. Or maybe you're casting it on the thief because they're the advanced scout.
Yeah, it's not something to rely on for a whole party.
Maybe as an act of desperation.
you could cast this on, say, a guard or something who's out on patrol, and then as he's moving through his patrol, his tracks just suddenly disappear, and then you take him away and go and interrogate him, and then he actually disappeared like 50 yards away from where his tracks end, but nobody's going to go searching 50 yards when his tracks disappeared near the river or the drawbridge.
So that's our take on the animal friendship and pass without trace spells. Let us know how you've used them in the past. Moving on to our next section, we're going to talk about the Complete Ranger's Handbook and our resources section. I personally like the sections on the kits. I think they did a really good job giving a good variety of ideas for ranger classes to play. I do like the mechanical advantages it gives. I wish they had more mechanical hindrances, but overall, I think it's really fun to see some of the new ideas and the new ways to play an old ranger class.
My favorite part is just the expansion on the whole class itself. It gives you more detail on what followers you can have, the behavior of what you can train the followers to do. It expands on all of the ranger abilities, like the species enemy and like moving silently in the natural settings. And it gives more information on how a ranger would manage stronghold. And it also gives details on how to actually roleplay a ranger in social settings, which was something that never really got properly addressed in the player's handbook. It's always been that they were these Aragorn-type characters who were skilled fighters, but they lived on the outskirts of society, fighting off monsters and defending the lesser man. Has always been kind of the default assumption of them, or potentially even just skilled bowmen who were once hunters and then they took up the art of mercenary work or something along those lines. And so this gives a much larger and broader expansion and many more suggestions on how you can actually incorporate it into a social campaign.
I would say that I like the different terrain options that you can choose to be specialized in as a ranger, as well as their expanding on species enemies where you have the tables based by terrain. You can roll to see which one is your, you know, favorite or species enemy. I like some of the new ranger spells that they added in this book as well. Some of them are a little odd, but others are pretty interesting. The kits, I like the kits, and actually some of the ranger-specific magic items that they add in here, we actually are going to talk about one next, and those are some of the extra things in this book that I like. It just really expands on what the ranger is and can do. And it's even pretty cool that they go in depth to kind of explain what a foregathering is and how they can go.
There are a lot of useful things in this book, and I really do need to pick it back up and go through it again. I didn't know what the Ranger's Foregathering was, but it does sound interesting, and I need to kind of catch up on it. I don't think it would play out in my world right now very well, the way the world is going, but it is something I can see maybe adding in once things settle down in my world and the party can get back to normal adventuring. I really like how much they threw in all of these handbooks that allowed players to look more into the different types of character classes than just what originally came in the player's handbook that, oh, you're a wizard. Oh, you're a ranger. You're a paladin. And they were very cookie cutter classes. And I like that they allowed players to expand their role playing, expand their characters, so they could be a lot more than what was just originally thought of in the player's handbook.
I definitely miss them in the newer editions. I've been wanting them to bring them back, but it doesn't look like they're going to anytime soon.
Well, it's hard to say what 5th edition is going to end up doing since they tried getting back to their roots with the newer version. Maybe D&D Next will take us back to 2nd edition and some of the expansions that they had back then.
Yeah, and it does seem like in the new 5th edition, they've been trying to bring back some of the classic adventure modules that are out there as well.
They have, and they've been bringing back a lot of the old canon characters as well, basing a lot of the books and modules off of those canon characters.
I think that's something they try to touch on with every edition, though, is they move from first to second. They try to take all those modules and all those characters that were canon characters and bring them forth into it. I don't know how much they actually ended up doing with third or fourth, but I did read that they were going to bring in a lot of those things from those old editions into the newer edition. So you can go play Keep on the Borderlands or Against the Giants and be able to take new characters into some of those really fun old modules.
I'm partially hoping, but also not terribly since I don't use them very often, but I'm partially hoping that they bring back the Die Vecna Die module and write it in a much more understandable manner, because that one felt like it got really confusing later on in the book.
There were a couple modules, not just the published modules, but in the dungeon magazines that kind of went astray and were a little hard to understand. Okay, trying to get back from our sidetrack, let's move on to our next section and talk about the Chameleon Cloak. This is our Enchanted Pages section, and the Chameleon Cloak is found in the Complete Ranger's Handbook, page 92. Ed seemed very excited to talk about this, so we'll let him take lead.
Okay, so this is one of the two that I favor out of the Complete Ranger's Handbook. It's a lightweight cloak, which covers the wearer from neck to foot and also includes a hood. It may be worn comfortably over studded leather or lighter armor. The color of the cloak automatically changes to blend in with your surrounding terrain. So if the wearer enters a jungle, the cloak becomes mottled with the patches of green and brown so that you blend right in with your surroundings. Same thing with if you're in the Arctic, it will blend in with the snow and you are basically rendered almost invisible. At night, it becomes black. The color changes are instantaneous. Chameleon Cloak allows the character to be personally camouflaged as if they're using a camouflage proficiency in any terrain. The Chameleon Cloak can only conceal one person at a time. The cloak conceals with an effective wisdom equal to its rating.
I think this can be a very fun magic item. It's not overly powerful. It allows one character to blend in a little bit better with their surroundings and works very well for a scout-like character. It'll allow them to scout ahead, not be seen. If they are seen, then they can just switch their terrain a little bit, like run behind a tree, turn brown and green, and then they're not going to be spotted as easily. It's a fun little item that I don't think will ever throw a game off balance.
I don't see it why it would. It's not really any different than if you happen to have one person that decides I'm going to take camouflage proficiency, or somebody that casts invisibility randomly or on themselves.
Yeah, I feel like the giving a player the invisibility spell is significantly more powerful than the Chameleon Cloak.
I think it can be just as effective. Being invisible, yeah, you're still going to make sounds and whatnot, so invisibility on the wrong character, say a fighter, you're still going to hear him coming. Somebody using the Chameleon Cloak, you're going to give it to a scout, so the rogue or the ranger or somebody who's a little more silent is going to be able to make a lot more benefit from this than a fighter or even a wizard is from an invisibility spell.
All around, I do like it, though. It is a pretty solid magic item.
It's no Mace of Disruption, though, mind you.
Yeah, but you're a ranger, not a paladin. Well, I suppose if you guys don't have anything more to say about this, I could mention the other two items that I wanted to list here.
Absolutely.
So another of the magic items that are in the Complete Ranger's Handbook that I like is the Portable Shadow. It happens to be on page 93. Pretty much it's similar to a portable hole, except that it's actually a portable shadow. So it resembles a gauzy black circle about 10 feet in diameter that can be folded up into a pocket, or a packet, excuse me, of about 6 inches square. When unfolded and laid on any horizontal surface, the portable shadow looks like any normal area of shade. It is as dark as a shadow cast by a tree or other solid object under a midday sun. This magical item is useful for concealment and makes as good a hiding place as any natural shaded area. Rangers, thieves, and others have their normal chance of hiding in shadows when standing in a portable shadow. Pretty much it's like the portable hole, except instead of containing things, you can actually use it to use your hide in shadows skill.
I've never heard of this. This is pretty fantastic. I like this one. I might give it to some people just to see what they do with it.
Hey, what's that little thing folded up in your pocket?
Yeah, I'm tempted to do the same thing as Saul, because I didn't really know about this item either. So I can see myself throwing it at one of my party members. Just see what they do. Of course, knowing my group, they'll give it to the fighter for some reason.
Yeah, because the fighter can hide in shadows, right?
That's just a thing that the fighter seems to be the default for magic items. Everybody's got two or three magic items, and then the fighter is just a walking magic store.
And unlike a portable hole, I would allow them to throw this into a bag of holding without any incident.
Just a matter of finding it.
Yeah, I would have no problem giving this to any of my players either.
Of course, it'd be fun to watch them try to use it in middle of a well-lit area and, hey, there's that shadow right smack dab in the middle. Where'd that come from? Who's... And I don't know, I just see them trying to do that and not really knowing that I, as a DM, are going to be like, yeah, that's pretty blatantly obvious. They see you anyway.
Standing right under this torch sconce, why is it so dark?
Yeah, why is there this huge 10-foot area of shade when it's just a tiny little torch? The last thing I was going to mention is the Boots of Varied Tracks. The wearer of these ordinary-looking boots is able, on command, to alter the tracks they leave behind. So they can be walking along, and according to the two tables that are listed here with it, all of a sudden now they're leaving bear tracks behind instead of tracks of a human, or an elf, or whatever. Then they can decide that they want to change it again. Now they're leaving the tracks behind of a hill giant, or a camel, or a dog, or a goat, horse, lion, mule, rabbit. You come up with whatever you want on these two different tables, and that's the type of tracks you're leaving behind. This can really throw off anybody that's trying to track you.
True, if you start leaving behind giant footprints, nobody's really going to keep going in that direction.
So by default, these will allow the wearer to change their footprints to as small as a halfling or as large of an ogre. In addition, you can roll on the tables, and you can get up to four different types of tracks. So each set of boots is going to vary from boot to boot, but anywhere could allow themselves to maybe change into whether it's rolled as a dog, a camel, maybe a rabbit, or even so much as a wyvern.
And that's why I like these boots so much. I'm going to give these to a ranger that's in my game that happens to be in the desert, so then they just start randomly leaving these oddball tracks.
What are these human tracks doing alongside a man scorpion?
Yeah, I could see myself modifying the tables a little bit too to maybe make some creatures outside of what they list. I mean, they've got goat, dog, camel, but I can't see why you couldn't make it a rabbit or a dragon or manticore or something along those lines.
He's leaving the tracks of a beholder. Wait a second. I could see altering them to be more fitting to the type of setting you're in. So if you're in maybe like a northern type setting, you could say instead of camel tracks, they're leaving behind like moose tracks or deer tracks or something.
Both great flavors of ice cream as well. So those are some fun magic items you can throw at your rangers or some of your other party members. Let us know if you've ever used these or some ideas you might have for a ranger as far as magic items go. Moving on to our next section, we're going to talk about animal companions. These are found in Chapter 3 of the Complete Ranger's Handbook. Using these charts, you can determine the results of the maximum number of followers the rangers will receive over the course of their career. On pages 31 to 34, you can find the different terrain type tables that you can use to attract their followers.
Yes, and actually the Player's Handbook has a table for followers of the ranger on page 41 for the Revised Handbook.
My favorite part about this section is they give you the standard method of training animals and then the alternative method of training animals. And the standard method is just the same thing that's in the Player's Handbook. But the alternative method gives you almost a score of how many things that you can teach to an animal with a trainability rating. And they range from negligible to low to medium and to high. And this determines how long it takes to train them a thing. And then also how many things they can learn. For negligible, it takes 2d6 weeks to train them one command. While for high, it takes 1d4 weeks to train one command. And then it also gives you, with each rating, more advanced things that you can teach them. Such as with negligible, you can teach withdraw, come and stay, and attack, which allows you to, you know, attack and command. While with low trainability, it adds on to those heal, sit, speak, fetch. And if it's a animal like a horse or a bear or something that you can ride, you can have carry, which will tell it to run over and throw you onto its shoulders. So that's something that really expanded on that aspect and is also the thing that I ended up allowing my ranger that used animal friendship. I allowed her to use this to train her falcon.
I like the way that they went about showing how a ranger attracts his followers. They give you a lot of ideas of different ways that they can join the ranger. I also really appreciated them giving the ranger the ability to attempt to acquire a specific type of follower. If they really want a wolf, there's rules in here for them to acquire that wolf. It's not a guarantee, but it gives them an increased chance of getting what they want.
Yeah, because it looks like if you go by the Player's Handbook, it's pretty much a percentile die roll by possibly the DM or the player, and that's what they get for a follower.
And I do like that they gave you three or four pages of just charts that you can look at. I mean, you don't even have to roll the number. It just gives the DM or the player a good source of what's available in this type of area. If it's a forest, we can do a bear or a badger or a pseudo dragon. But now we're in a jungle, so maybe he attracts a lizard man instead. So it's just really nice to have that kind of point of reference to where It'll make it easier for the DM to pick something, throw it at the ranger, and continue the campaign without losing a whole lot of flow while you're sitting there. Oh, crap, what do I add to the party? What do I give to the ranger? Who's going to be attracted to him and follow him? It's just a really nice tool, and I do like that they added this in for our reference. And they even went so far as to add in a table for the Underdark followers. So they tried to cover a little bit of everything. So you've got some great ideas here of what to throw towards a ranger when he starts attracting his followers.
And you don't even necessarily have to use them by this is the type of terrain you're in now. Maybe that's the terrain the ranger picked that they're specialized in, so those are the types of followers they're going to get for an option.
I still like to introduce those things in a logical manner. So if they're in the mountains, I'm not going to throw a squirrel at them. It's going to be something in the mountains.
Are you trying to tell me squirrels aren't in the mountains?
I'm saying they're less likely to be found in the mountains.
But I just saved a squirrel from that puma.
Well, then you can have him as a follower.
A squirrel now has a life debt unto you.
He can show me where all of his nuts are.
Does he have his own armor and weapon?
No, I have the dwarf. He's going to forge him some.
So as you can see, we've gotten sidetracked a little bit in this chapter. That's our take on animal companions. Let us know how you've used them. Moving on to our last section, we are going to move on to Librum of the Players. We'd like to discuss the various ranger abilities and how players can use them. I think one of the reasons why a player might pick a ranger is for the tracking ability. If you follow the core rules, the tracking ability is something that is extremely expensive to purchase unless you're a ranger. It's also a stat that even if you have it, you make your skill checks at a penalty versus what the ranger gets. If you want to be able to track something through the woods or even through a city, you're best to have a ranger at your side.
That, and don't the rangers, if I'm remembering correctly, get tracking as a free kind of give me proficiency?
Yes, it is a free ability for them, and anybody else has to spend 3 to 6 points, depending upon which version of the game you're playing. If you're using skills and powers versus the non-skills and powers version, it's an extremely expensive ability to take, and if you only get 3 non-weapon proficiencies to start with, and this is your one choice, you're still suffering at penalties to use it.
I know it seems like every time there's a ranger in any of the games I run, they always try to use the heck out of their tracking ability. But it's nice to also see they get some abilities that normally you would only get if you're a thief or thief class character, like hide in shadows and move silently. Those can come in extremely handy.
They're more geared to an outdoor setting, but yeah, they are very beneficial, especially when the rogue is your urban hide in shadows, move silently guy, then you can have your ranger as your outdoorsy hide in shadows. So you've got different types of stealth depending upon what setting you're in.
That, and you don't always have to have the same person be the scout. If we're out on the road, the ranger's the scout. He's the lead guy in our marching order. When we're in an urban area, the thief takes over the lead, and he's the one scouting.
And let's not forget about the most important, at least to my player's ranger ability, is the dual weapon ability. The ability to pick up a weapon in each hand, fight with it without any penalty whatsoever.
That is without a doubt one of the best abilities of the ranger. It has some pretty good ones, such as tracking, as we mentioned, and survival, which is an ability that I've seen used quite a few times to effectiveness. But the ability to dual wield without the -4 penalty, I believe it is pretty significant.
It can be achieved in the skills and powers by taking enough of the abilities, but after you've spent so many points, it takes a fighter or paladin a considerable amount of time to catch up to where the ranger starts off with automatically. In the standard rules, if you're not using skills and powers, you get a -2 to attack with your main weapon, -4 with the offhand, and that's offset only by your dexterity score.
And then there's two other abilities that a ranger has that I'm not necessarily as thrilled with, but I suppose you could make good use of them, which is nature lore and animal empathy.
I think that ties them to the druid a little bit. It allows them to be outdoors, be able to kind of associate with the animals out there. If they don't have their spell casting yet, they can at least kind of get a feeling of where the animals are and maybe find a way to calm them down. I'm talking about animal empathy. And then if you're talking about the nature lore, if you're wandering through the forest and you need a poultice to help somebody who got bit by a snake, he's the one you want to go to if you don't have a druid.
Or someone with herbalism.
I think I would give the person with nature lore a little more ability than somebody with just basic herbalism, unless they specialized in the areas of poultices and whatnot.
Or you could always have that oddball thief that happens to know about poisons. Maybe he also has some, like, anti-venoms.
That is true. The ranger can be the end-all be-all of everything, but giving him that ability might help the party out from time to time.
I think really it all matters on how the person playing the ranger uses those abilities and skills.
I think that wraps up another episode for us. Let us know how you've played rangers, how you've seen rangers played. Let us know the abilities you prefer and the ones that maybe don't sit well with you. Shoot us an email at librumofthedm@gmail.com. Leave us a comment on our community page or post something on Twitter or Podomatic. For those of you who didn't hear the last episode, our Twitter address is @librumofthedm. In our next episode, we're going to talk about paladins and their holy powers. Maybe we'll talk about some anti-paladins. Stay tuned. This is DM Mike saying, look out for that third arm.
And this is DM Ed saying, you can't see me because I've got my chameleon cloak on.
This is DM Saul wishing to see you well at the next foregathering.
No foregatherings for you. You're kicked out of the group.